This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, welcome back to the Winter 2015 Distinguished Speaker Series. This is our third installment. Excited about all my speakers, but especially excited about these three amazing women that we have up here. These introductions are going to blow you away. They blew me away, and I think I'm going to be exhausted after I read them. These women have accomplished so much in such a small amount of time. We'll start with Kristen Hayer. She is the Vice President of Customer Success for The Resumator. The Resumator works with small, medium-sized, and even large enterprises to help them identify, recruit, and hire top performers. Well, so what? What they also do is they help companies work through stereotypes by focusing, such as gender and race, things like that, by focusing on performance. So the Resumator is a new tool. It's a new hiring tool that allows companies to look at who will be a top performer based on some criteria of success that they've experienced in the past. Prior to joining the Resumator, Kristen was the VP of Sales and Support at Vertical Response. She led revenue and customer experience, so she was in control of the P&L. She was driving, basically, the force of that business. She's been in sales, marketing, and customer success. She's been a leader in those spaces for well over 20 years. While she was working full-time, she also founded a startup specializing in the design of engaging, playful environments for kids. So again, this is someone who's extremely busy, working in a startup, working full-time, and she still found the time to give back to her community, and in this case, to children specifically. She's passionate about building strong leaders. She doesn't run one. She doesn't run two. She runs three discussion groups for current and prospective leaders. Again, all in her spare time working at a startup. She also serves on the board of Brisbane Dance Workshop, which is a local nonprofit that encourages students or encourages young people to express themselves through dance. She's a frequent speaker on customer success. She's out there in the marketplace speaking at conferences because of her extremely strong track record in that area. She earned her undergraduate degree from Seattle Pacific University and her MBA from the University of Washington. She lives in the Bay Area. She traveled all the way down here to beautiful Santa Barbara to spend time with us. She lives there with her husband, who is a successful business owner in his own right, and he's also a stay-at-home dad, and her lovely daughter, who is a 10-year-old cupcake entrepreneur. Let's give Kristen a hand. Rose Broom is here as well. Rose is the co-founder and CEO of HandUp. I love your company. It's a crowdfunding site for homeless people and other neighbors in need. 100% of the donations from HandUp go towards things like food, medical care, housing. And they do that through partnering with service organizations. So that's just a wonderful thing that when you give money, you're knowing that you know that 100% is going to go to a very specific use and not just some amorphous organization that might or might not help the person. She has been named one of 30 women entrepreneurs making a difference by the Business Research Guide and one of 19 extraordinary women in Silicon Valley by Business Insider. Her work has been covered by CNN, BBC, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, San Francisco Chronicle, and TechCrunch, among others. Last year, her and her co-founder were named one of the top 10 people in tech by Business Insider. Before she founded...
Top 100.
It just says top people
well,
here.
We're not that cool.
It just says top. She was named the top person in tech. And her co-founder really didn't win anything. I just said that to make him feel better. I'm kidding. Before she founded HandUp, she worked as the COO of Super Better Labs, which was and she managed product when she was there, as well as conducting research with academic partners. Before that, before Super Better, she pioneered predictive modeling research, where she was working with social networks and trying to associate student outcomes with data. So she's very much a data scientist. She was also, prior to that, a data manager for Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. She earned her undergraduate degree in campaign management from Santa Clara University and her master's in psychology research from San Francisco State University. She's a firm believer in technology's capacity to solve the world's grand challenges. And she's worked to inspire collaborations between the tech community and social good organizations, not just with her current startup, but really throughout her career. Let's welcome Rose. And last, and as you will see, not even close to least, Summers McKay is here with us as well. She is the CEO and founder of Delight Wipes, among other things. She had earned her MBA from UCLA's Anderson School and her undergraduate degree in mass communications from UC Berkeley. She is smart, naughty, and fun, and you can be that and still be successful in business, believe me. She's a former business school teacher, and she's an expert in millennial branding. Delight Wipes, her current company, is creating a pH balance product to assist men and women in sexual hygiene as well as enhancing their sexual intimacy. She is something that's cool about her business besides just the obvious impact of her product. She's giving 5% of the net profits to organizations that support sexual health and wellness education. She's not a first-time founder. Previously, she launched a new business for UCLA back in 2012 called Edge, and she generated a profit within her first year. She was a serial entrepreneur before she even knew it. She was a 10-year executive with Paramount Pictures, and she left to go to a startup organization called Roar, and that was back in 2007. She's also, as if that wasn't enough, co-author of a book called Running with the Kenyans, Heartfelt Stories of an American Doctor in Africa, which she wrote, and she's written a number of articles that have been featured in Morton Report, the San Diego Tribune, and things that are not top news. She also publishes her own blog, which I strongly encourage you to check out, called Caution Curves Ahead. And she regularly appears on the Huffington Post as a guest, a featured guest and a panelist. Let's welcome Summers as well. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. And I'll see you guys next week. No, not quite. So I really do appreciate all of you taking the time to come down here and talk to our students. One of the things we talked a lot about, traded emails about, was the fact that we want to balance having a gender-oriented panel with the reality that women entrepreneurs are really no different. Now, there's a professor here at UCSB, Sarah Thebaud. She has focused on women entrepreneurs as her area of study. She wrote her PhD thesis, and that's what her area of study of research is now. And her research, among others, has shown that there still are unconscious stereotypes about women entrepreneurs. And what's frustrating about that is when you also look at the research, the things that those stereotypes are based on just simply aren't true. And it comes down to what characteristics do people think women entrepreneurs have or don't have that men have. In reality, when you test it out, we all have the same characteristics for risk-taking, for leadership, et cetera. But when you have this, when there are stereotypes, I think they need to be addressed. And so that was one of the things we wanted to make sure that we touched upon. So this is really a panel of entrepreneurs who happen to be women. And we will also, at the same time, talk a little bit about things that are specific to women entrepreneurs, but also just entrepreneurs in general. So I think there's something here for everyone. I think we're all going to learn from the process. So one of the things I asked the professor was, okay, great, there's a unconscious stereotype. We need to work on that. What would you propose women do to help alleviate this reality? And I'll let, we don't have to go down the line or whatever, but I'll give you guys a chance to talk, and then maybe I can share a little bit about what the professor thought. But what if we're going to just kick it off with, what are your thoughts on, let's just assert that that is a reality, what can women do about it?
I can jump in.
See, women are so polite. Men would fight each other to be the first, right? They're rude. Go ahead.
I mean, there are so many things. Like, we could spend the whole night just talking about this one question.
Right.
But, one thing that I found with entrepreneurship that whether you're a man or a woman, you're going to face is you're going to hear no a lot. And you have to get used to that really quickly. And, are you hearing no because you're a woman, or are you hearing no because they don't like your idea? Or are you hearing yes because they like your idea? Are you hearing yes because you're a woman and they want to help you out? You're not going to really know. But everyone hears no a lot, and one of the most important things about entrepreneurship is get used to hearing no and pick yourself back up and get out there, because you have to knock on 100 doors, no matter if you're a man or a woman, and find those people who want to help you and the people who say yes and who open their doors to you. And there are a lot of them out there, whether you're a man or a woman, and put your energy there.
Yeah, don't take it personally, right? Because it's not personal.
I would tap into what Rose just said and add to it, in the sense that I think you actually do take it personally. I think entrepreneurship should be about you as the individual, regardless of your gender. So you are different than me, and we both happen to be women, but those characteristics that make us good entrepreneurs are far more salient to the process of selling. So it's find a product you're passionate about, find a business you're passionate about, find something that is so intrinsic in your soul that you can't not do it. And then, so take the business step very personally, not the rejection.
Right, right.
But make it less about if you're a guy or a girl, make it about who you are and what is the business that you in your soul must do.
I agree with you guys, and to add on to that a little bit, I believe that, you know, putting your best foot forward as you're going out in front of investors or in front of people that you're trying to pitch your product to is really critical as well. I think, you know, making sure that your presentation as you're going out and pursuing funding is top notch, making sure that you've got your ducks in a row, all of that's really important regardless of your gender. And I think, especially as women, it's really important that you're going out and maybe getting a coach before you're looking at funding, just to make sure that you do have all your ducks in a row and you can compete. It's a competition regardless of your gender. I just got to watch my boss go out after our Series B round of funding, and they went and knocked on a lot of doors, right. And it took a long time. He's a guy, you know, and it took just as long for him to go do it as it would for a woman to do it, I think, as well. You just have to get used to being told no, mm-hmm. and pulling your pants back up and back out the door. So, yeah.
You know, I think use that energy constructively. I mean, I was told no a lot. I mean, and I never said, well, that's because I'm short. You know, it's like, I am short. But I don't think that's why people were saying no to me. It was probably because I wasn't pitching appropriately. I pitched to the wrong person. My message was terrible or whatever.
We hear a lot. I was at a panel last week, and a woman stood up to ask a question and proceeded to commandeer the conversation for all of 3 minutes and then say, and nobody will invest in me because I'm an older woman entrepreneur. And I stood up and I was like, nobody's going to invest in you because you can't read a room. It had nothing to do with her gender. It had to do with that she couldn't read a room. So don't blame automatically that you're not going to get investment because of your gender.
Right.
You know?
Right.
There could be many other reasons.
Right. Right. And don't use that as a crutch. We're not victims. We're out there to control our own destiny.
Yeah.
So one thing the professor, because I asked her that question, she wasn't able to be with us. She's in Australia, actually, giving a talk on women entrepreneurship. And I asked her what is her advice. And one of the things she said I thought made a lot of sense, which is don't be afraid to promote yourself as a woman. Men do it all the time, right? And so men kind of do it second nature. She said, you know, if you assume there might be a bias, again, unconscious, I don't think it's a cabal against women, but if there's, you know, some unconscious bias, just be very forthright about, the way she says it is, reduce uncertainty whenever possible. Okay, so you're looking at me, you don't know anything about me yet, I'm going to let you know something about me, and I'm going to let you know in a very assertive, polite way. And I think it's just one way that you can sort of alleviate maybe this uncertainty that might be there and might hurt you down the road subconsciously. So here's a question from one of the students. I will read this question. How do you circumvent the stupidity of men without explicitly telling them they're stupid? And I might say you could insert men or women in there, because there are stupid women out there too.
I think we all loved this question when it came through by email. How do you circumvent the stupidity of anyone without telling them they're stupid? Well, you can't actually tell someone they're stupid and really get far in business if you're in a business where you have to sort of negotiate and create relationships. And I've been told not to swear, but when I used to manage interns, I gave a talk called Managing Your A-Hole, because everybody has one. And when I was in the entertainment industry, a lot of people were working for agents and managers who were just jerks, yep. And that's how they behaved. And a big part of it is, one, identifying early on what it is their expectations are, serving them, and finding a job that you enjoy where you're not working with the a-hole. Like, a lot of us in business now have the no a-hole policy. Yep. We won't work with people
who are... I call them
are,
douchebags.
Yeah.
But.
Okay. The no douchebag, is that okay? Okay.
It is.
Are we allowed to say douchebag?
It is
we're
going to
find out what all
we're
the
gonna
good
find
words
out
we
all
can
the
use
bleeps.
Are.
Exactly. So, but I think you're gonna work with people who are challenging, and that comes from experience and maturity and knowing how to better negotiate and navigate relationships. But sometimes it goes back to not taking it personally. Right? They're just out there. So that was my thought. But we all immediately responded to that question. So
yeah, my thought was, whoever you are, it gets better.
So here's what I think about that one. You're going to work with people who have all different kinds of strengths and weaknesses, whether you're the manager of the team or you're, you know, working under somebody. And try to figure out as soon as you can what strengths this person has. And maybe this person isn't a very analytical thinker. You're not always going to have people who have the same kind of abilities on your team, but maybe they're very visual. Or maybe they do a lot to bring the team together socially. See what their strengths are and try to encourage those areas and find other people that can work with them to compensate for, you know, their either the things that they just really aren't going to be able to develop or help support them in the areas that they can grow. You know, obviously, if you're working with somebody that is, you know, being very rude or confrontational or, you know, just like not productive on your team, then you need to, you know, figure out if you still want to be on that team or if they need to be asked to leave the team. But if it's just kind of an intelligence gap, you know, that's life. And you know, part of your role as the lead is to make the most of it with everyone.
So this might seem like a trivial question, and this isn't one that I served up to you guys ahead of time. So it's we'll see what your response is. But when I was in business, I never hugged anybody. It was just, my wife has kind of made me very, very huggy now. I'm a bit more huggy. But in business, it just didn't feel right to me. How do you guys feel about that? You're younger than me. Have you experienced that in the workplace? That do you just sort of cringe, or is it no big deal? Or
This is really
for the guys out there.
Yeah.
I'm a hugger, but usually with guys in business, it's the lean hug. It seems more business appropriate. But yeah, I think now, especially in the more casual industries like tech, it's fine. And it's really up to you. I've sort of learned that there's a few people at work who are not huggers, and so I don't sort of force myself on them. But yeah, I think it's okay.
But who should, what would you advise a young, or not so young, male? Like, what should initiating a hug?
I think I have a slightly different perspective on this. It's like, look, guys, when in doubt, ask.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're a hugger and you want to be affectionate with the people you're working with, ask. Say, can I offer you a hug or a handshake? Or, you know, kind of wait and read their body language. If someone comes to you with a handshake, they don't want to hug you. And that's okay. And I don't want to hug everyone. And,
right.
You know, if I think sometimes being affectionate and laid back, that's great. And being genuine and authentic with our teams is great. But not everybody wants physical affection from the people they work with, and that's okay too. I think free hugs is great, but only if it's an option, not if it's mandatory. So, you know, just keep that in mind and don't take it personally if somebody doesn't want a hug.
I would concur. I have found, and some of the questions that were sent, note the particular type of industry that I have found myself in. I have actually found myself being more reserved than I used to be. Mm. So based on the business that I am launching, I've had to kind of change my way of presenting myself. So I am absolutely a hugger, but I am much less of a hugger now than I was.
Well, that kind of segues into another question that was more specific to you.
Yeah.
And so one of the students, and they wanted me to ask this question again, was how... That was one example. Are there other examples of you're in an intimacy industry? How is that? Do you find it's frustrating to talk to people, or is it, are some people not sure how to handle that conversation?
Absolutely, and this is true regardless of the startup that you're in. You have to find the right investors and the right partners. When I made this decision to launch Delight Wipes, it came from a lot of discussion with my thesis team back in graduate school, friends of mine, about a sexual health problem that exists worldwide, such sexual education and sexual health, the absence of it. And I decided it was a problem I wanted to attack from a for-profit business structure. I wanted to make a very successful sexual health and wellness company that could contribute back. I didn't want to just go into a nonprofit donation of my time. So the notion of going into this business, I had to at one point sit down with my mom and my dad and sit across the table from them and explain to my father the company I was starting. They still are not sure about it, but they also understand sort of the genesis and the reason that I'm doing it. I was thinking today about how one maintains professionalism, and ultimately numbers talk, finance talks. The natural intimate care industry is a $1.5 billion industry already. It's growing based on our total available market, right, top down or bottom up. But our TAM for Delight Wipes, there are in just the millennial market, 3 billion acts every year, which we could participate in. And at 30 cents an act, that's a pretty good number. So that's a 9 billion TAM. So maintaining sort of professionalism in the reasons one's starting a business and the inception of it, and maintaining maturity, also being able to be playful, and then backing it up with the numbers. This is not just a hobby. This is a huge industry. With our hashtag, which is Make Love More, we're starting our Make Love More campaign. You know, everybody wants it or everybody's having it. So let's service that market was really our goal.
Great. So just be professional, go by the numbers, and make sure you're talking to the right people.
To the right people.
It doesn't matter what you're selling or what your business is. Most people, like what Rose said earlier, I say no to most people that come to us for money because they're just not a good fit for what we do. It doesn't mean they don't have a good idea or that I don't believe in them as individuals.
Yeah.
So make sure you're targeting. Yeah. So we'll take the next question, a student question, in a moment. I have another question from a student that I will read. Do you guys have a mantra, or is there something you go back to when you feel like you're sort of fighting against this male-dominated entrepreneurial industry, or is that just like not an issue? Is there something you tell yourself to kind of remind yourself to stay strong, or you're just like, what?
So
what
I'll,
issue?
I'll take that to start. It's not so much for me to stay strong against sort of this male onslaught, because I don't really feel like that's really there for me at this point in my career, but just to stay strong in general. I have a demanding job. I have a lot of stuff that I'm doing, and it's really easy when things happen to get a little bit discouraged. And so when work is stressful and I'm doing a lot of projects and I'm kind of getting down, I come back to why do I go to work? I go to work to help the people who work for me achieve their career goals. That's really what I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about developing leaders on my teams and helping them grow into their careers. And so when I bring myself back to that and I think about why do I go to work, it helps to kind of center me back on why do I do this. Mm-hmm. I love my job and I love all the aspects of what I do, but the thing that I'm really passionate about is career development for my team. So that's what I do.
Okay.
So for me, I'd say this is not something that I think about every day. It's real, and we need to think about it and address it and have conversations like this about it. And certainly, you know, women in tech and women in business is a conversation that's going on a lot right now. And I'm happy to participate when I have that opportunity. But, you know, what I wake up thinking every day is, how do I make my company successful? and really focusing in on getting things done. And there are only so many things we can control. Do what you can to make an impact on this issue in your own life and in the life of the women around you and the people that you can reach. And some things, you know, are going to take a lot longer for us to, you know, tackle. So do what you can, but, you know, focus on what you're actually working on.
And I just want to reemphasize that when Rose says do what you can, she's super, I mean, everyone in this panel is super busy. Rose is, you know, just raised money. She's, you know, you're running a business, for God's sake. And we struck up a conversation and talked a little bit about how difficult it often is to field a panel like this. The way Summers and I became associated was this very issue.
Yeah.
Summers was trying to get speakers for her class over the summer in business school, and she found that to be challenging. I think actually ended up in the Wall Street Journal, and it was great because it caused a conversation to happen. Some people just didn't necessarily agree with what I had said because it was an article I wrote, but I still think it spurred debate, which is important. We've talked a little bit about that. I think individually, I know I shared a conversation with you about that. So it's easy to say to women, hey, step up, show up, be on stage, don't be bashful. And that is important because the tendency is often not to do that. But the reality is women are often asked to do everything else in the household, including running a business, including stepping out. So that's what I found because I did have several people that said, I'd love to do it, but I can't for this or that or the other reason. And oftentimes it was a family related issue. So I know you and I talked. I don't know if you want to add that. It was kind of a diatribe, sorry. But I'm just so excited that, you know, we have a great panel up here. I find with men, it's typically I get a quick yes, and they're there because they don't have that other obligation.
I think the mantra that I was thinking about that a lot, and I think the mantra for me is be the role model you wish you had. You know, I am very, very fortunate that I have that I have a family that is supportive of me and a partner who is supportive of me, and that I am able to not get burdened with the 100% of the household duties. I would say that choose your partner well. Choose someone who is willing to support your goals. When you're setting out to do that, because if you don't, it makes it not possible.
Right. No, I think you have to have some difficult conversations at the outset.
Yeah.
Here's the journey that I would like to go on. Are you coming with me?
Are you part of it?
Yeah.
You're either in it or we can't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
no,
I'm in a similar
advice.
Situation. We were talking about this earlier. I have a husband who is about 16 years into his career in social work and was pretty burned out. And it was right about the time that my career was taking off. And we kind of looked at each other one day and decided that we needed to start having some of those difficult conversations about the fact that we probably weren't going to look like the typical family. And that for us, it made more sense for him to be a stay-at-home dad and for me to go get my master's degree and continue working full-time and be an executive. And so it's the best thing that we ever did for our family, but I couldn't have done that if he wasn't the kind of person who was willing to step outside of societal norms and if he wasn't the type of person who was willing to have that kind of an open conversation. And so I think you're absolutely right. You have to pick your partner.
And be honest. Be honest with yourself and be honest, hopefully, in your partner's conversation. We'll take the first question from the audience.
My question is for Kristen. While at Vertical Response, you were the vice president and sales team leader. What were some strategies you put into place for underperforming sales members?
Oh, for underperforming sales members?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I like to do when I come into a new team to just set the tone right off the bat is have a session with the team, which can be a little scary, where I really lay out what my expectations are for them up front. And if it's a sales team, it's here's the sales goals, and I expect you to hit them. If it's a support team, it's, you know, here's how quickly we need to respond to cases. Whatever the metrics are for the team, I put them out there. And then I talk about what happens if you don't hit your goals. For my teams, it's usually you get a verbal warning, maybe two, depending on the company I'm working for. You get a written warning, and if you continue to not hit your numbers, you're gone. I've not had to fire as many people as I think I would have had I not started telling people up front what my expectations were. So I'm just very clear when I communicate with my teams. When I do have somebody who's underperforming, what I've told them is, if you get a verbal warning from me, it's serious. You need to pick up the pace. And if you get a verbal warning, I'm still in coach mode with you. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to help make you successful at that point. If you continue to not do what you need to do and you move to the stage where it's a written warning, my perspective shifts and I'm now in protect the company mode. And I am going to do everything I can to collect data to make sure that when we fire you, my butt's covered. So it's basically turned my teams into teams that if they get a verbal warning, they take it super seriously and they do what they need to do. I'm also a really strong believer in training. And so when I have new people come on board, I spend a ton of time training and coaching them and making sure that they have all the tools and materials that they need to be successful in their roles. And so I think you can do a lot as a leader to prevent somebody from ever getting to the stage where you need to let them go by being a very clear communicator up front and giving them the tools and the training they need to be successful. Does that answer your question? Okay, great.
Rose, I have a question for you. And Summers, anyone can chime in. Summers already talked a little bit about her fundraising efforts a little bit. Mm-hmm. You've recently raised quite a very nice round. So what do you have any advice just in general about fundraising or anything specific to women that are raising money?
Yeah, so fundraising is one of the hardest things that you'll do as an early stage entrepreneur. It is very difficult, but it's essential in getting your company off the ground. So for me, when I was fundraising for HandUp, HandUp is a very different kind of company. It's a for-profit company that's doing social good. And we're a new kind of organization called a benefit corporation. And so when we were pitching investors, we're pitching them on a business that's helping homeless people and people in poverty. So right up front, we had an extra hurdle than other startups have, which is talking to investors about a market that they're very unfamiliar with. And so, you know, that definitely took some getting used to and, you know, learning how to pitch and really how to, you know, sell your business. But the biggest part of it is that it's an endurance game. And if you've, you know, read about Steve Jobs and how he fundraised for Apple in the very beginning, he had, you know, a list of 100 investors that he talked to. And that's no joke. That's really how it is. And you have to be willing to keep going, knock on as many doors as you can. When someone says no, you know, ask them, do they know anyone who might be interested? You know, talk to all your friends, go to networking events, so many different things to get out there and to find the people who want to support you. But some good news is that the hardest part is getting the first investor. And so for us, I had just started fundraising, you know, been talking to different people, and went on a show called This Week in Startups that an entrepreneur and investor named Jason Calacanis is the host of. And, you know, over an hour, he's grilling me about HandUp and why it's a business. And at the very end, he says, you know, I want to be the first investor in HandUp. I think this is awesome. And that was just like such an awesome moment. I like FaceTimed my team as I was in the elevator afterward, and it did get easier from there. And so often finding somebody who's really passionate and believes in what you're doing is going to make a big difference. And that's part of why having a network and, you know, hopefully a mentor network can really help a lot too.
Well, a lot of it is getting the word out. As you're telling that story, so our firm has invested in one woman CEO so far. We're looking for more. And we found her this week in D.C. with Mark Suster.
Okay.
So not that we found her. We knew her before that. But when I saw that broadcast and saw her interview, I wanted to invest in her because it's very similar. Mark, you know, went over a business model, you know, why is this a good investment, all those things. And by the end of it, I was really like ready to write a check. It's quite extraordinary. So take every opportunity you have to get on these shows. They are watched quite widely, and it makes a difference. Can you tell us a little bit about Google and how you got $500,000?
For our fundraise to support Hand Up, we raised $850,000 from a whole bunch of different investors, Jason being the first, but a lot of other great investors came on as well. And, you know, one thing that was really exciting for me about Hand Up is that while it, you know, it's a business, it's also a social cause. And so I wanted to tap into all of the resources out there that I possibly could. And, you know, a lot of foundations give money toward, you know, early stage organizations and for charitable purposes. And so started kind of talking to different foundations, and Google.org, which is one of the most innovative foundations out there. We were excited to announce in December that they gave us $500,000 grant, which was very exciting. And, you know, for us, we plan to continue to take advantage of the best of both worlds, of, you know, the power of the for-profit business model and the startup ecosystem, as well as the charitable giving world, to make the biggest impact we can by making Hand Up as successful as we can.
That's awesome. We'll take the next student question.
All right. Thank you all for coming. My question is directed towards Rose. Working as part of a presidential campaign is something that most of us probably find incredibly interesting and impressive. Can you please talk about what specific skills and relationships went into forming this opportunity, as well as the impact you had on the campaign and the impact it had on you?
Well, you got him elected, right?
All because of me. So, funny story. When I first saw Obama speak at, it was the 2004 presidential convention where he was speaking on behalf of John Kerry, and I remember thinking, that guy's awesome, I wish he was running for president. And so then when I found out he was running, I was excited, I made a donation, and my friend tells me, he says, hey, I'm going to this Obama fundraising party thing, you know, why don't you come? So I said, okay, great. And I show up, and it turns out to be an organizing meeting for the general election. And the organizer there is like, everyone in this room needs to sign up for a leadership responsibility. And I was like, whoa, I thought this was like a cocktail party. So, you know, sometimes just being opportunistic and finding yourself in the right place at the right time. And so I said, okay, well, I know about data. I love stats, so I'll help you guys with data. And so I was the first data volunteer for the San Francisco office. We weren't focused on San Francisco. We were focused on swing states. But from there, political campaigns are a lot like startups, because they start small, it's volunteers, people come in, and then it scales really quickly. So in 8 months, you know, I went from being the only data volunteer to having, you know, 15 people on my team, to having a team of 200, to then having thousands of volunteers that I was managing, to being part of a regional team that was kind of this like command center. And it was an amazing, exhilarating experience. And I did more than I ever thought I possibly could. Politics will, you know, definitely help you learn where your limits are. And I knew after that I had to leave academia and leave research and do something that I felt had a bigger impact using technology. I hope that answers your question.
So we talk a lot about mentorship in this class. It's something near and dear to my heart. Summers has already mentioned that you want to be the role model that you wish you always had, and I think that's a wonderful, attitude and approach. And I'll open this up to any and everyone. I know you had a mentor that I know. Mm-hmm. I know of. So can you talk to a little bit about any mentors or role models you've had in your life and what really worked, whether it was a man or a woman, what really worked in those relationships? And then, you know, sort of in the eyes of these young people that may not have a mentor yet, how can they get a relationship similar to that? Big question.
Yeah. I have a mentor, Promise, who was my boss up until very recently at the Resumator. And I happened to kind of stumble across her doing some networking on LinkedIn. We got connected, and you know, she had a position that she was interviewing for on the team for a VP of customer success. So we got talking. We spent about 2 months kind of checking this out and seeing if we liked each other and seeing if, you know, this was a good fit for both of us. And it's over the past year as I've worked with her, it's been an incredible mix of learning from her by watching her as a boss and having a relationship with her as more of a friend where I can ask her career questions that I might not otherwise be comfortable asking a boss. It's actually, in a way, kind of nice that she's not my boss anymore, right? Because I feel like I can be a little bit more open about, you know, sharing with her what's going on in the workplace and getting her feedback and advice. But to be honest, she's the first mentor that I can say I've really had. And I'm fairly late in my career at this point, and so I feel like there was a long period of time where there wasn't really anybody. But as I was thinking about your question and thinking back over my career, I actually have found that the best kind of mentors were not really formal mentors for me. It was actually a process of observing people at work, both good and bad. I actually have learned some of my best leadership lessons from having really, really terrible bosses. really terrible bosses. And you know, you learn from them because you think, gosh, when I'm a boss, I am never going to do that.
Yep.
And so that's, I think, where a lot of my mentorship has come from, is just observing people at work. And I think that that's something that anybody in here can do, even if you don't have a formal mentor relationship. You can be observant and you can see what works and what doesn't work for other people and learn from that.
When we think of mentor, I think everyone imagines that there's this one person who you go to for everything, and that's just not realistic. pardon me. People are incredibly busy. People also can't serve all your needs. I think the best times in my life, when I advance most in my career, is when I find several people that become what I call my advisory board. So if you think of yourself as a startup, you need an advisory board. Our companies all have advisory boards. So when I think of mentorship, you know, my very first job at Paramount when I was 19 years old, I'm still friends today with the six people who led the divisions that I was interning for, because I went and made an important relationship with each of them. And so I didn't count on any one of them, but I, as you said, you know, you find the skills. What is this person good at? What do I have to learn from this person? So I think mentorship is something, it's almost more of a portfolio. You certainly never go to someone and say, like, hi, do you want to be my mentor?
Right.
That's just creepy.
You don't go to Craigslist?
Yeah. Casual encounters, mentor space. Like, it's just creepy. But I think, yeah, you have to develop sort of what are your needs. And you have to be very realistic with yourself. What is it that I'm lacking? What is it that I need right now? And then go find someone who is talented at that thing and learn from them.
The time and the desire.
Exactly, the time and desire and the personal connection.
Right.
There should be like a Tinder for mentors.
Left.
Yeah, so I, you know, from the time that I was 8 years old, had a woman who I had babysat for, and she was a VP of engineering, and, you know, was a friend to me, almost like a mother to me, who I've, you know, since, you know, now that I'm older, I'm like, oh yeah, I guess she was a mentor to me all that time. But I don't really, I have a lot of people that I get advice from. Beside Mary, I don't really consider anybody to be my mentor. But I want to put out some advice around this that is,
you need to be talking to and getting advice from people who are doing what you're doing and people who are one step past it. So if you're fundraising, get advice from, you know, investors or other mentors, but talk to founders who've just raised money because they know the like real scoop and what's going on. And then the other thing is take everything with a grain of salt because no one knows. If they knew, then they would be doing it. And this was actually one of the great things about talking to lots of investors and hearing no is that people would say, oh, you should totally do this thing. And then other people would say, that thing, that's totally wrong. Yeah. This is the way to do it. And these are like smart, successful people that have totally different opinions. So be careful with taking advice from people. It's just one perspective. It's a clue. You have to trust your own intuition and, you know, like Summers was saying earlier, follow your own passions and motivations.
Well, I like what you said because it's Jeff Bezos stole this from someone where he said something to the effect of listen to everyone and ignore most of them. But the first part's very important. Like, even when someone's telling you no and you think they're wrong, listen to why they think that. Because it may be the way you projected your business, right? Mm-hmm. It may be that they're saying no because of the way you prefaced it. So listen to everyone, ignore most of them. Tough to do, right? It's easier to say it. We'll take the next student question.
The gender imbalance in the tech market is a continuous problem that is rooted in the idea that there is only a small pool of technical women to recruit from. Do you believe this to be true? Why or why not? And also, have any of you overcome gender discrimination on your way to way to success? And how did you resolve the conflict?
This is such a complex question. Yeah. This is such a complex question. And, you know, I think this is what earlier you were hinting at, of even having these kinds of conversations can sometimes be very sticky and tricky. It's really complicated. There are so many factors that go into this. Is there a gender imbalance in tech? Yes. What are the causes? I mean, there's all different kinds of causes. But, you know, from my perspective, I see that we're having a lot of these conversations. I see a lot of support networks coming up for women. I do see a lot of female entrepreneurs. We need more of them. Yes, let's continue to encourage that. But I guess, like, straying a little bit from your question, I think one thing that can often really distract us is the very visible cases of, like, blatant sexism, discrimination, and harassment. Right. Those things are wrong, and they're very important that we call them out and that we don't tolerate them in you know, in tech or in any other, you know, industry or profession. But, you know, like, Sarah's research is focused on unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem with letting the big flashy examples hog the conversation is then people think, I'm not sexist. I think women are equal. I'm not discriminating against women. I don't know what you're talking about. And, you know, I think when we can put on the lens of, like, the unconscious bias, that framing is so much more useful for us to think most people aren't intentionally discriminating against women, but discrimination is happening from men and women, and we're doing it to ourselves, and we're underselling ourselves, and all these other things are really happening. And so I think I would like to see, and I, you know, I love that, you know, part of this conversation was framed this way, is like steering more toward the, you know, unconscious bias and what can we do about that, both in terms of what women can do and what men can do and what investors can do and what managers can do as well.
And I think it takes a certain level of courage. It may not be obvious to, you know, lots and lots of people are going to watch this on video, but it may not be obvious to everyone in this room. I had a great conversation a couple of weeks ago, not trying to fill the panel. The panel had long since been filled, but with a Harvard-educated, you know, Harvard MBA, very successful woman. I don't want to get too specific, call her out. And we had this conversation, and I said, you know, I have this speaker series, maybe in some future, you know, lecture, you can get involved. I would never say that on film. Like, she just shut down. She said, I would never say that. I would be labeled in a way that I don't want to be labeled. She lost all her courage. Mm-hmm. You know, she was happy to say it to me in dinner, but she lost her courage to say it in a public setting. So it's like, well, if we're not going to say it in a public setting, then how is this ever going to get resolved in any way? Five generations later, maybe? I don't know.
I had an interesting experience when I started my MBA at UCLA Anderson. I don't know why I'm coughing so much. You guys make me nervous. but there was a class of 72, and there were 14 women in the class, and it's a small program, and so I rallied all the girls together, and I was like, okay, we're going to be like, I had imagined this like sisterhood, call it the sorority girl in me, but I was like determined to create like that the 14 of us would be best friends and would help each other with our careers forever and ever. And I had started writing Caution Curves Ahead, and I was talking about women in business, and one of the women in my class, who's just absolutely beautiful, curvy, long hair, feminine girl, said to me, well, I don't ever want to be seen as a woman in business. And I looked at her and I was like, you got a problem. Like, you are a girl. You are a woman. You do have that. And so it is that struggle, right? I don't want to be seen as a woman in business, but I do want to have femininity. And so learning to help women understand that beautiful and feminine is also powerful and successful, that some of the skills and abilities that we do have uniquely as women, our negotiation tactics, our collaborative tactics, our ways of managing do inherently make us successful. And that notion that beautiful is powerful is something that we have stripped away. In this sort of gender neutering of we're all the same, well, we're not. Right. Like, I guarantee you, none of you guys, like none of the guys spent as much time on their makeup today as I did. Like, but part of that, part of my ritual of preparation for a meeting might be hair and makeup. That might be that's my way of getting into my game face. That doesn't make me a less effective business person. That doesn't make, you know, so understanding that femininity and not feeling like you're in a pool, isolated, there are so few of us, but instead we are who we are and embracing the individual, you know? I think we often forget that there is power in femininity, and that's okay to say it's there too.
Yep.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I occasionally run into is sort of this bias that is there sometimes, but you kind of start to second guess yourself as a woman, where you're like, is that really, you know, a bias, or am I just reading into it, or, you know, it's like, what is this really? And what I've learned to do just for myself to kind of combat that is to just go after what I want in a more direct way. I had a situation come up actually last week at work where I was running through that in my head. I was thinking, I didn't get asked to be a part of this group that's going to be brainstorming marketing stuff for our company as we go forward. I have all of the customers of our company. Why wasn't I included in that? Is it because I'm a woman? And because all the other people on the group were guys, and I was kind of like, I got a little bit offended, and I thought about it, and I thought, well, that's not what it is. It probably, you know, just got left out. But instead of sort of letting myself get frustrated by that, I went and asked to be a part of the group. I talked to the CEO and said, hey, you know, I think I would be better on this team instead of the team you stuck me on. How about you stick me in? He goes, oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah, let's put you on this team. So, I mean, it was a bias that really wasn't there, but I was kind of reading into it. And so I think that happens as well. And it's tough to know how to combat that other than just to try to bring it to the surface so that you can see if it's really there or not.
But I like that you said, hey, I think I can add value here, and that's where I want to be. And if an organization rejects that, you're in the wrong place,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Whether
that's
you're a man or a woman, you're just saying you know, I think my talents are better served here. Mm-hmm. And unless I can give you a rational argument as to why that's not the case,
yeah,
then there could be other issues, and I don't think it has anything to do with gender. So speaking of gender issues, so there's a recent Forbes article that's indicated that 41% of women polled, and we talked about this in the first speaker we had, a very successful woman entrepreneur. She talked about crying at work. I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So this particular poll said 41% of women had reported they cried at work, only 9% men. The men are lying. It's probably more than 9%. I've cried at work, so I'm in that 9%. But it seems to be a disparity between men and women. How have you dealt with that? Have you had to experience it yourself and or with other people, men or women, that were getting emotional at work? And what advice would you give these folks?
I think anyone, when you're about to cry, breathe, right? So losing, crying, like, it's if the emotions are getting heightened to a point where somebody's about to burst into tears, you as a manager, your job is probably as a manager or a leader to step back and make sure everyone's breathing. Because nothing's going to get done when your team's in tears. People get embarrassed when they're crying. I've had guys and girls that I work with, and you know, whether it's production or education or any of the businesses that I've been part of, it's high and it's intense and there's stress. So if you're about to cry or you see someone that you're working with about to cry, get everyone to take a step back and breathe and realize that that's part your fault too. As if you're, if you got someone you're working for who's about to cry.
If it's escalated.
You've escalated. You've done something wrong. I firmly believe that business should not be a place where people are forced to tears or forced to a breaking point. Mm-hmm. I think business can be done well and successfully without trying to drive people to tears.
Yep.
That's, you know, I guess that's my perspective.
So I have a slightly different take on this that I have just like, I always want to keep it real. And, you know, with Hand Up, we work with a very emotionally charged issue, homelessness, poverty, and we hear heartbreaking stories all the time. And we're making decisions about our product and our direction that sometimes can turn into, you know, heated discussions because we feel so passionately about, you know, the direction the company can take. I've seen both men and women cry, and it hasn't always been in a bad way, though. Like, you know, I've had a time where there was a communication issue, and, you know, we're really committed to open communication on our team. So we're like, hey, you know, there's some tension here. Let's sit and talk this out and, you know, let each person share, like, what's going on for them, what's the issue. And sometimes that can be, like, a very emotionally relieving. And, you know, there were tears in that situation. I didn't see that as a bad thing. I saw it as people, you know, being real and expressing themselves. You know, I work in a startup, so it's a very different environment. We're, you know, a team of six people. Mm-hmm. So we're very, very close with each other, and it's not quite as, like, professional of a kind of corporate environment that you might find in a bigger company. But I don't know. If I feel like I'm going to cry, I'm going to cry. And, you know, if you feel uncomfortable with that, you can excuse yourself and go to the restroom. Like, you know, maybe I want to go to the restroom and get a tissue or whatever. But I don't know. I just think crying can keep it real sometimes.
I agree. I think crying is a release valve, and it's human, and every single person does it. And it's so looked down upon in business, and it's seen as weakness. And I don't think that that's true. I actually think that women sometimes start to cry because they're angry, not because they're sad or depressed. I have had more men cry in my office than women by a long shot. And not because I make people cry a lot, but I think that people often bring stuff from their personal lives to work, and that's reality. You don't just go to work and shut off everything that's happening in your life. Family members die. You have a bad relationship happening at home. Those things can cause you to tear up and cry.
Right.
And it's normal, and I don't think we should look down on it. I think it's something that we need to start to change as we go forward in business and not look at emotion as something that's bad, but look at it as something that's natural and normal, mm-hmm. and figure out great ways to deal with it that are positive.
Right. Well, I do really appreciate you guys coming up here. It's an important topic. You guys, I think, shed some interesting opinions and light on it. And if you guys are wondering what three strong, spirited entrepreneurs look like, who happen to be women, in parentheses, take a look up here. These are great role models for you guys to follow. Let's give them a hand.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.